In 1845, a ship docked in Old Harbor carrying over 260 Indian laborers. They came in silence with nothing but turmeric seeds, sacred chants, and hope. What began as indentured servitude blossomed into one of the most resilient cultural legacies in the Caribbean. From curry pots to Diwali lights, tasa drums to temple bells, this is the untold story of how India's spirit took root in Jamaican soil. It's not just history, it's identity, and it's still alive today. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, The First Crossing, Arrival of a New People, 1845. The year was 1845. On the calm morning of May 10th, the sails of the SS Blundell came into view off Jamaica's southern coast. It wasn't a slave ship. It wasn't a cargo vessel filled with molasses or sugar. This ship carried something new, something that would quietly yet permanently transform the island's cultural DNA. More than 260 Indian laborers, men, women, and children, disembarked at Old Harbor. They came from the northern regions of India, mainly Bhojpur and Awadh, lands now located in the modern-day states of Uttar Pradesh and Bihar. Some spoke Bhojpuri. Others prayed in Sanskrit, reciting the Hanuman Chalisa beneath their breath. Most had never seen the sea before this voyage. They had not come by choice. They came by contract. Following the 1838 abolition of slavery in Jamaica, the British colonial system was scrambling. Plantations, once powered by the unpaid labor of enslaved Africans, were now desperate for new hands to cut cane, sow fields, and keep the sugar economy alive. The British turned to a system they knew well, indenture. Indentured labor was framed as a fair contract. 5 years of work in exchange for wages, food, housing, and a return ticket or land to settle. But the truth was murkier. The voyage from Calcutta took months. Conditions were cramped, disease spread easily, and cultural isolation loomed before a single foot touched Jamaican soil. Many of these first arrivals believed they were only coming temporarily. A handful clutched small bundles of seeds, turmeric, or religious idols wrapped in cloth, fragments of home they hoped to plant in new soil. What they found was a strange and often hostile land. Jamaica was recovering from the tremors of slavery's end. The African-Jamaican majority had been granted freedom, but not land, not power, and certainly not equality. Into this simmering society stepped a new group of people. Brown-skinned, but not black, foreign in language, religion, and food. They were labeled coolies, a term later reclaimed in some circles, but used derogatorily by many at the time. The colonial government implemented a system to manage these new arrivals. Overseers explained contracts, sometimes poorly translated, and sent Indian laborers to estates across the island, especially in Clarendon, Westmoreland, Portland, and St. Mary. Each worker received a number, not a name. They were expected to clear fields, plant cane, and perform backbreaking tasks alongside African-Jamaican laborers who often viewed them with suspicion. Language barriers, cultural divides, and colonial manipulation sowed early tensions. And yet, even in those first months, resilience took root. Women wore saris in the field, tying them tightly for work. Men made rotis from flour and water when they could, fashioning makeshift tawas to cook on open fires. At night, laborers sang Bhojpuri folk songs, biraha, songs of longing, echoing across the cane rows under the Caribbean moon. Religious observance persisted quietly. Some fashioned clay idols, others traced Rangoli patterns in dirt outside barracks. With no temples, trees became altars. Coconut oil lamps were lit during Diwali. The Hindu god Ram and the Islamic call to prayer found refuge far from the Ganges. But the system was not gentle. Contracts were rigid. Wages were docked for illness or lateness. Complaints could be punished. Some Indians died from fever, malnutrition, or exhaustion within months of arrival. Others attempted to flee the estates, only to be captured, fined, or imprisoned. Still, thousands remained. Some were promised land at the end of their term. Others simply could not afford the return trip home. A new generation was born on Jamaican soil. They would not speak Bhojpuri, but Patois. They would not return to India. They would become Jamaican. By 1870, the system had expanded. More ships arrived. More Indians came. Eventually, over 36,000 between 1845 and 1921. Roughly two-thirds would remain. What had started as labor migration was now a community. It wasn't immediate. It wasn't easy. But it was real. Indian heritage in Jamaica did not arrive in fanfare. It arrived in silence, with the shuffle of bare feet on a gangplank, the crinkle of a turmeric leaf in someone's pocket, and the whispered prayers of a people determined to survive. Today, Old Harbor remembers this crossing every May 10th, Indian Heritage Day. But the true legacy isn't just marked by festivals. It's in the curry that simmers in Kingston homes. It's in the names like Marag and Singh. It's in the pride of a new generation that says, we came by ship, we stayed by struggle, and we lived through legacy. This was the first crossing, not just across the ocean, but across culture, faith, and time. And it was only the beginning. Chapter 2, Life on the Plantations, Contracts, Culture, and Colonial Control. When the first Indians arrived in Jamaica, their hopes were wrapped in promise, a five-year contract, a plot of land, a way to earn, return, or rebuild. But life on the plantations quickly revealed a harsher reality, one shaped not by opportunity, but by control. The indenture system was designed to fill the labor void left after slavery was abolished. On paper, it was a legal agreement. But in practice, it was a colonial mechanism to extract labor with minimal rights, minimal cost, and maximum obedience. Once assigned to estates, Indian workers were governed by rigid rules. They were expected to rise early, labor from dawn to dusk, and maintain the same output once demanded of enslaved Africans. The difference? They were now paid a few shillings, but even those wages were often docked. Illness, lateness, or refusal to work could result in deductions, corporal punishment, or imprisonment. Each indentured laborer was registered, numbered, and categorized. Contracts were written in English, often incomprehensible to the Bhojpuri or Awadhi-speaking migrants. Many signed with thumbprints, unaware of the full scope of their obligations. In the fields, conditions were brutal. The Jamaican sun was relentless. Tools were crude, and accommodation was bare. Barracks built for efficiency, not comfort, housed dozens of workers in tight quarters. Sanitation was poor. Water was limited. Medical care, where available, was basic at best. But perhaps more isolating than the physical hardship was the cultural dislocation. Religious observance was restricted. There were no temples. Hindu rites were seen as exotic or pagan. Muslims found few resources to practice Islam openly. Meat slaughtered according to religious custom was hard to come by. Fasting, prayer times, and dietary preferences were often ignored by estate managers. In many cases, the colonial authorities enforced Christian Sunday rest days while simultaneously preventing workers from observing Indian religious festivals. The psychological toll was immense. Families were often split. Men were prioritized in recruitment, leading to a gender imbalance. Women, when present, were vulnerable to abuse, to isolation, and to being bartered for marriage or companionship. Relationships formed, but heartbreak was common. To manage dissent, the colonial system employed surveillance. Overseers kept close watch. Whispers of rebellion or resistance were reported. Indian workers were fined for insubordination, a charge that could be as vague as disagreeing with a supervisor or declining additional labor. And yet, even under surveillance, the culture survived. In the evenings, workers gathered in hidden spaces to cook familiar foods. Lentils, rice, turmeric, and chilies, when available, became spiritual nourishment. Women sang folk songs that told of rivers back home. Men formed small circles to tell stories from the Ramayana or share news from other plantations. They created miniature Indias in the cane fields, temporary but real. Intercultural contact also began to emerge, though slowly. African-Jamaican workers, many of whom initially viewed the Indian presence with suspicion, began to notice similarities. The rhythms of the Dolak resembled the Mento. Herbal remedies shared roots. Spiritual sacrifice, respect for ancestors, and the power of drumming. These were bridges, not borders. Still, tensions remained. Colonial authorities stoked divisions to maintain control. Indians were given separate housing, rations, and work units. They were told they were not like the formerly enslaved. This divide-and-rule strategy served empire, not community. Despite the walls placed between them, Indo-Jamaicans were adapting. Some learned patois. Some converted to Christianity to access privileges or protection. Some married outside their group, forming what would later be known as the Dugla identity, children of African and Indian ancestry. By the 1880s, a small but growing number of Indians were petitioning to stay in Jamaica permanently. The idea of return to India, once a goal for many, had begun to fade. The idea of belonging in Jamaica had taken root. Those who completed their five-year term had choices. Some accepted repatriation, but many took the land grants offered by the Crown and began farming small plots of land in Clarendon, St. Mary, and Portland. Others moved to Kingston, seeking new lives as barbers, fishermen, shopkeepers, or traders. A few saved enough to send for relatives. Their children would be the first to call Jamaica home, not as laborers, but as Jamaicans. By the early 20th century, over 20,000 Indians were living on the island. Many more would come, and though the indenture system would formally end in 1921, its impact, both in pain and perseverance, would echo through generations. The plantations may have been designed to erase identity, but instead, they became the crucible through which a new one was forged. Indo-Jamaican identity was born in the fields, not in freedom, but in endurance. And that endurance would grow into a culture that would one day redefine what it means to be Jamaican. Chapter 3, Roots in the Soil, Settlement and Integration. By the dawn of the 20th century, a quiet but permanent shift had taken hold. The days of indenture were winding down. The British colonial government, after decades of bringing Indian laborers to Jamaica, officially ended the system in 1921. But for tens of thousands of Indians who had completed their contracts, a deeper decision had already been made. They would not go home. They would plant new roots. Roughly two-thirds of the Indians who came to Jamaica between 1845 and 1921 chose to remain. Some were granted land instead of return passage. Others stayed because they could not afford to go back. A few had been born in Jamaica, children of the sugar fields, fluent in patois, unaware of India, except through their parents' stories. They settled first in the rural parishes where they had labored, Clarendon, Westmoreland, St. Mary, and Portland. These communities began modestly, clusters of thatched homes near cane fields, with a cow, a small garden, and maybe a mud stove for roti and dal. But even in these humble beginnings, resilience flourished. With their agricultural knowledge, many Indians turned land grants into self-sufficient farms. They grew rice, pigeon peas, okra, turmeric, and bitter melon, produce that would eventually influence Jamaican cuisine itself. Curry leaves, tamarind, mustard seed, these once strange flavors began to mix with callaloo and yam, creating something new. Over time, Indo-Jamaicans began shifting from field work into trade. In Kingston, A few migrated toward the urban sprawl, becoming jewelers, barbers, tailors, shopkeepers, and fishermen. These professions offered more autonomy, a way to build stability outside plantation control. Their communities remained close-knit. Temples were not yet widespread, but small shrines adorned family yards. Hinduism and Islam were practiced in private, away from the curious or suspicious eyes of the wider society. Marriages were arranged through word of mouth and community elders. Family names like Singh, Marag, Jaghai, and Brijmohan began to appear on land records, store signs, and school rosters. At the same time, cultural interaction with African Jamaicans began to deepen. Children went to the same schools. Marketplaces became shared spaces. Festivals were watched from across fences. And slowly, lines that once separated communities began to blur. It wasn't always easy. Racial hierarchies, shaped by colonialism, positioned Indians as in between, not white, but not black. They were sometimes viewed with suspicion or misunderstanding by Afro-Jamaicans, and in turn, held on to their distinctness for cultural survival. But history doesn't sit still. Intermarriage increased, especially in urban areas. From these unions emerged the Dugla identity, a proud cultural fusion of African and Indian heritage. Dugla children grew up hearing calypso and chutney, eating both curried goat and ackee and saltfish, navigating two rich legacies. This fusion wasn't limited to people. It extended to festivals, music, food, and language. Jonkanu, Jamaica's masquerade tradition with African roots, began to absorb Indian elements. Some masqueraders wore saris or turbans, and drums resembling the tabla joined street performances. In small gatherings, Indian folk dances blended with reggae backbeats. Even Rastafarianism, which emerged in the 1930s as a black liberation movement, showed signs of Indian spiritual influence. The use of ganja for meditative clarity, the concept of liberty, righteous living, and dreadlocks bore resemblance to Hindu sadhus and ascetic practices. In the face of social pressure to assimilate, many Indo-Jamaicans found ways to both adapt and preserve. Some anglicized their names, others converted to Christianity, while quietly honoring Hindu rituals at home. Children were given English first names and Indian middle names. This duality allowed for survival in a world that often demanded sameness, while secretly safeguarding cultural continuity. And yet, as time passed, the Indo-Jamaican voice began to grow louder. Local newspapers started covering Diwali celebrations. Community centers hosted Hosai processions. Politicians and artists of Indian descent began to emerge. And by the late 20th century, Indo-Jamaicans were no longer the quiet minority working behind shop counters or in cane fields. They were active shapers of Jamaican culture. Their story is not just one of survival, but of quiet revolution. They took a system meant to exploit and turned it into a platform to build. They turned barracks into homes, contracts into communities, isolation into identity. What had once been a scattered migrant workforce was now a people with stories, customs, cuisine, and pride stitched into the very fabric of Jamaica. These were no longer visitors. They were Jamaicans, just as rooted in the island as the aki tree, the djembe drum, or the patois tongue. Chapter 4, Curry and Culture, the Culinary Influence of Indian Jamaica. If identity lives anywhere most honestly, it lives in food. It simmers in pots passed down through generations. It lingers in spice blends carried across oceans. It speaks without words, telling stories of where we came from, what we held sacred, and how we chose to survive. In Jamaica, Indian heritage is perhaps most vibrantly expressed through its unmistakable impact on the island's cuisine. Curry, roti, dal, tamarind chutney. The flavors are now so embedded in everyday life, most Jamaicans hardly remember they were once foreign. But they were. When Indian indentured laborers arrived in 1845, they brought with them not only tools and family heirlooms. They brought flavor from the kitchens of Uttar Pradesh and Bihar, they introduced a bold culinary vocabulary. Spices like turmeric, cumin, coriander, fenugreek, cardamom, and garam masala. These weren't just ingredients, they were identity. Yet the early days offered little luxury. Colonial estates provided rations, often inadequate and bland. But even with meager supplies, Indian workers adapted. They grew pigeon peas and okra beside sugarcane rolls. They cooked dal, lentil soup, over open fires, mixing yellow split peas with turmeric and garlic. They made roti from wheat flour and water, kneaded by hand, and cooked on improvised metal towers, flat pans heated with coal or firewood. Over time, a Jamaican twist emerged. Curry, a broad term that doesn't exist in India in the way the West defines it, became a Jamaican staple. Local cooks adapted traditional Indian stews to include goat, chicken, beef, or chickpeas, simmered in deeply seasoned sauces. Scotch bonnet peppers, native to the Caribbean, were added for heat. Thyme and allspice blended with Indian spices to create a distinctly Jamaican curry profile. Pungent, earthy, and hot. One dish above all rose to national prominence, curry goat. Once reserved for special occasions, weddings or funerals, curry goat became a fixture of Sunday dinners and roadside cookshops. Its preparation is almost ceremonial. The meat marinated in vinegar, garlic, curry powder, pimento, and thyme, then slow cooked until tender. Served with white rice or rice and peas, often with coleslaw or fried plantain. Another favorite, dal and rice, or dal bhat, remains a comfort food in Indo-Jamaican homes. Its humble simplicity, yellow split peas, turmeric, salt, and garlic, belies its emotional weight. It is the taste of survival, of memory, of home. In urban centers like Kingston and Montego Bay, Indo-Jamaican restaurants and stalls began offering fowlery, spiced split pea fritters, aloo pies, samosas, and chutneys made with tamarind, mango, or shadow benny. Though rooted in Indian origin, these snacks took on a Caribbean life of their own. Crispier, spicier, sweeter, roti shops became landmarks, especially in places like Crossroads and Halfway Tree. Served wrapped or bus-up shot style, roti became more than a bread. It was a vessel of cultural pride. These dishes didn't remain isolated. They spread. African Jamaican families adopted curry into their kitchens, often without knowing its Indo-Jamaican roots. In street cookshops, jerk chicken might sit beside curry chicken, sorrel beside tamarind juice, plantains fried beside samosas. The lines between Indian and Jamaican cuisine blurred, not through erasure, but through union. Food became the great integrator, a silent, fragrant bridge between worlds once separated by colonial design. And it wasn't just about sustenance. Food became a medium of resistance. During indentureship, when prayers were restricted and languages dismissed, a simple roti became an act of preservation. A well-made curry was a form of cultural literacy passed on when books weren't available. Recipes were taught by hand, by taste, by memory. Dishes carried secrets, not just of technique, but of homeland. In the 21st century, this culinary legacy is thriving. Diwali dinners draw Jamaicans of all backgrounds. Restaurants like Pushpa's, Raja's, and Roti Hut serve lines that wrap around blocks. Indian spice blends are now packaged and sold in supermarkets island-wide. Jamaican curry powder, once an import, is now an export, with its own signature blend different from Trinidadian or Guyanese versions. Even among Jamaicans with no Indian ancestry, the phrase "me love curry" is universal. That love story began in hardship, in hunger, in longing, but it bloomed into something that now unites palates and people. To eat curry in Jamaica is to taste migration, survival, and fusion in one bite. It is to say, we're different. And yet, this is all of ours now. Curry didn't just season food. It seasoned the culture. Chapter 5, Faith in a Foreign Land, Religion, Ritual, and Resistance. When the Indian laborers first set foot on Jamaican soil in 1845, they carried more than tools or spices. They carried gods. They carried prayers whispered in Bhojpuri, verses recited in Arabic, rituals practiced for centuries. And yet, for the early generations of Indian migrants, religion was not merely a comfort. It was a quiet resistance, a way to hold on to identity in a world designed to strip it away. The majority of Indian arrivals were either Hindu or Muslim, reflecting the religious diversity of northern India. But their new world was not built to accommodate either. The colonial establishment was Christian, and deeply so. Churches dotted the landscape. Christian holidays were national observances. Sunday was enforced as a rest day, not for rest, but for Christianization. Missionaries saw the Indian laborers as spiritual targets, encouraging conversion, particularly among children and women. And while some did convert, by choice or social necessity, many resisted in quiet, powerful ways. Hindu and Muslim practices continued, often in secrecy. Temples did not yet exist, so trees became altars. Banyan-like trees or mango trees served as makeshift mandirs. Stones were consecrated with vermilion. Prayers were whispered beneath stars. At Diwali, oil lamps, diyas, were placed at doorways. Children learned to chant Gayatri mantras or perform aarti, even without formal instruction. Muslims observed Ramadan quietly, fasting through the workday, and praying when no one was watching. Without mosques, they created secret space in cane fields or barracks. The adhan, call to prayer, may not have echoed from minarets, but it echoed within hearts. One festival, in particular, became an anchor of spiritual life for Muslims. Osai. Osai is the Caribbean expression of Muharram, the Shia Islamic observance honoring the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. In India, it was a solemn spiritual event. In Jamaica, it became both a religious observance and a public cultural statement. Each year, Indian Muslims would construct elaborate tajas, ornate, colorful mausoleum replicas made of bamboo, paper, and cloth. These structures were paraded through towns, accompanied by drums, chants, and processions. The spectacle was joyful and sacred, sorrowful and defiant. It was a visible proclamation. We are here, and our gods have not left us. African Jamaican neighbors began to attend. The rhythms reminded them of their own drumming traditions. The unity in mourning resonated deeply. Over time, Osei evolved beyond religious boundaries, becoming a festival of inclusion and shared memory. Meanwhile, Hindu practices also gained public visibility. As Indo-Jamaican communities stabilized and expanded, small temples began to appear. Shrines were built in homes, adorned with images of Lakshmi, Hanuman, and Shiva. Community pujas were organized. Births, marriages, and funerals followed Vedic rites. Brahmin priests were invited from abroad. Diwali celebrations expanded to include firecrackers, food fairs, and community dances. Even Christian Indo-Jamaicans, though outwardly converted, often retained Hindu or Muslim customs. Lighting lamps at weddings, consulting Hindu calendars for naming children, or observing fasting days with foods passed down through generations. This fusion of faith and survival was not without tension. Indo-Jamaicans were sometimes viewed as strange by mainstream Jamaican society, their gods too many, their customs misunderstood. Rumors and prejudice circulated, but the Indo-Jamaican spirit remained rooted. By the 1970s and 80s, Hindu and Muslim organizations had grown in number and influence. Institutions like the Sanatan Dharma Mandir in St. James and Islamic centers in Kingston became gathering places, not only for worship, but for education, social activism, and cultural preservation. And today, these traditions are not only alive, they are thriving. Each year, Diwali is celebrated in Jamaica with grand flair, complete with stage shows, Mehndi designs, Indian food stalls, and prayers for prosperity. Jose, especially in areas like Clarendon and Westmoreland, continues with vibrant community support. Drums echoing into the Caribbean night. Temples and mosques stand not in defiance, but in dignity. Physical testaments to faith that refuse to disappear. And perhaps most profoundly, Rastafarianism, Jamaica's homegrown spiritual movement, has absorbed echoes of Indian faith. The dreadlocked Rasta elder meditating in a ganja haze shares more than he realizes with the Hindu sadhu. The Rasta's ital food diet mirrors Ayurvedic principles. The reverence for natural living, reincarnation, and divine vibration bridges oceans. It's not that Indian faiths changed Jamaica's religious landscape in isolation. They merged, they influenced, they survived. Religion in Indo-Jamaican life has always been more than belief. It has been protection. It has been memory. It has been proof that no matter how far from home they traveled, they did not arrive empty. They brought their gods with them, and they never let go. Chapter 6. Festivals, music and masquerade, rhythm of the Indo-Caribbean soul. In every culture, celebration is resistance. When people are displaced, oppressed or forgotten, their music becomes memory, their festivals become freedom, and their masquerade becomes a mask, not to hide, but to survive. For Jamaica's Indian descendants, celebration has never been just entertainment. It has been a declaration. We are here. We are proud, we remember. From the earliest days of indentureship, Indian workers celebrated what they could, often in secret, always with intention. But as generations passed, those once hidden traditions grew louder, brighter, and more Jamaican. Nowhere is this more vivid than in the festivals, music, and masquerade that animate Indo-Jamaican culture. Jose, the beating heart of procession, the most iconic of all Indian festivals in Jamaica, is Jose, a commemoration of Imam Hussein's martyrdom in the Islamic month of Muharram. But in Jamaica, it took on a new Caribbean rhythm. In parishes like Clarendon, Westmoreland, and parts of Kingston, Jose processions became vibrant, emotional spectacles. Giant tajas, mausoleum replicas constructed from bamboo, tinsel, and fabric, were carried through the streets to the pounding rhythm of tassa drums. These drums, originating from India, evolved in the Caribbean to carry a syncopated, mesmerizing beat, a sound that pierces the body and stirs the soul. People of all backgrounds joined in the spectacle, not always understanding the religious roots, but feeling its gravity. Jose was never just a Muslim event. It became a Jamaican event, uniting Indo and Afro-Caribbean communities in collective rhythm, remembrance, and revelry. Indian music meets Caribbean pulse. While the early Indo-Jamaican community remained musically rooted in devotional forms, bhajans, kawalis, and folk songs, a fusion began to take shape as the generations progressed. Musicians like those in Rajasarani, an East Indian Music Lovers Association, began preserving and adapting traditional Indian instruments like the harmonium, tabla, dholak, and sitar, while incorporating Caribbean bass lines and vocal stylings. This fusion gave birth to Jamaican chutney music, a cousin of Trinidad's more commercial version, but rooted in rural communities. The lyrics alternated between English, patois, and Hindi, often addressing themes of love, family, food, or cultural pride. The rhythm was always danceable, the emotion always raw. At weddings, you might hear classic Hindi film songs played beside reggae. In some homes, elders still sing biraha, Bhojpuri ballads of longing and separation, passed down orally. In others, you'll find DJ sets spinning Bollywood remixes into soca and dancehall. Music, like identity, didn't stay pure. It became beautifully blended. Junkanu masquerade, an Indian influence. One of the most surprising and underexplored areas of Indo-Jamaican cultural expression is its impact on Junkanu, also known as Junkanu, Jamaica's masquerade tradition that dates back to slavery. originally rooted in West African customs of drumming, dancing, and masked performance during Christmas. Jankanu evolved over time to include influences from British military bands, Christian pageantry, and notably, Indian costume design. In the early 20th century, Jankanu bands began incorporating Indian characters, men dressed as warriors, in imitation of Maharajas or Bollywood icons, women in flowing saris dancing alongside queen and devil figures. Turbans, sashes, and bindis entered the masquerade, not as mockery, but as homage. Children would imitate Indian hand gestures. Chants took on cadences heard in Hindu processions. Even the Jab Malasi, a devil character from Trinidadian Carnival, appeared on Jamaican streets with Indian-inspired adornment. This was not cultural theft. It was cultural testimony, evidence of deep mutual influence in a society that refused to be boxed by race or religion. Diwali and Holi, lights and color across the island. As Indo-Jamaicans gained greater public recognition, Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights, emerged as a major annual celebration. What began as a home-based ritual with oil lamps and sweet treats grew into a national event. At temples like the Sanatan Dharma Mandir and Sri Lakshmi Narayan Mandir, Diwali nights became full-scale cultural showcases. Sari fashion shows, classical dance, Hindi karaoke, chutney competitions, and vegetarian feasts. Children learned Ramayana skits. Elders told stories of Rama's return to Ayodhya. Fireworks filled the skies. And for many non-Indo-Jamaicans, Diwali became an entry point into a world they had never truly known. Some communities also revived Holi, the Hindu festival of colors, a joyful celebration where neighbors splash each other with brightly colored powders and water, signifying unity, love, and the triumph of good over evil. In these moments, there are no indenture numbers, no caste, no colonial chains, only color, only light, only music, the Indo-Caribbean pulse. Today, festivals and music are not only preserved, they are evolving. Young Indo-Jamaicans are remixing their heritage. Some are DJs, sampling tasa into dub beats. Some are spoken word poets fusing Hindi and Patois. Some are reviving forgotten instruments. Others are simply playing the tabla next to a Marley vinyl, letting the vibrations speak for themselves. What was once hidden in plantation quarters now plays on public stages. What was once whispered in Bhojpuri is now shouted in dance halls. Because culture, like people, cannot be contained. It marches, it sings, it dances, and it remembers. Festivals were not just days on the calendar. They were a heartbeat, and that heartbeat still echoes from Clarendon to Calcutta, from Kingston to Kanpur, in the shared rhythm of a people who refused to forget who they were, even as they became something new. Chapter 7, Modern Revival. Pride, politics, and diasporic identity. For over a century, Indo-Jamaicans carried their history quietly. They built homes from sugarcane earnings. They passed prayers down in secret. They raised children who spoke English but tasted curry in every pot. But in recent decades, something changed. The silence turned to celebration. The background became the spotlight. A quiet survival story became a public legacy. This chapter in Jamaica's Indian heritage is about revival, a deliberate, defiant return to cultural pride. And it didn't happen overnight, the rise of Indian Heritage Day. In 1995, after decades of advocacy and cultural resurgence, the Jamaican government officially recognized May 10th as Indian Heritage Day, also known as Indian Arrival Day. The date marks the 1845 arrival of the SS Blundell, the first ship carrying Indian indentured laborers to Jamaican shores. But the recognition was more than symbolic. It was emotional. It was political. Each year since, Indo-Jamaicans gather at Chedwin Park in Old Harbor, the symbolic landing site, to celebrate their roots. The festival features traditional dance, drumming, cultural exhibits, religious rituals, fashion shows, food stalls, and interfaith prayers. It has grown into a national event, attracting Jamaicans of all backgrounds. The 180th anniversary, held in May 2025, was especially moving. Hundreds gathered in a sea of color, elders in white kurtas, children in bright lehengas, drummers pounding tassa rhythms, while political leaders, scholars, and artists took the stage to honor the legacy of Indo-Jamaicans. It wasn't just a celebration of the past, it was a claiming of space. Indo-Jamaicans were no longer asking to be seen. They were showing, proudly, publicly, and powerfully, that they had always been part of Jamaica's soul, education, and historical recovery. As the movement for cultural revival expanded, so did the scholarship. Books like East Indians in the Caribbean, academic journals, university studies, and oral history projects began chronicling what had once been omitted from Jamaica's national story. Schools began to include Indo-Caribbean history in social studies syllabi. College students founded Indian heritage clubs. Researchers documented indenture records, temple histories, and interviews with the descendants of early laborers. This knowledge wasn't just for posterity, it was a healing process. Indo-Jamaicans, who had grown up feeling in between, not white, not black, not fully Indian, finally had language for their experience. Their grandparents' sacrifices were now acknowledged. Their curry-stained school lunches were no longer a source of shame, but of identity. Bollywood, yoga, and modern influence beyond festivals and books, Indo-Jamaican influence has found new life in popular culture. Bollywood films, once watched quietly on DVDs or at small gatherings, are now screened at open-air festivals. Young Jamaicans of all backgrounds dance to Hindi film tracks on TikTok. Yoga studios in Kingston teach asanas with reggae playing softly in the background. Ayurvedic wellness trends are increasingly popular, and Indian restaurants dot the island, especially in Kingston and St. James. Cultural fusion is now part of the mainstream. Dreadlocks and saris coexist. Dancehall artists sample tabla. Roti shops share plazas with jerk huts. This is the face of modern Jamaica, one where Indo-Caribbean identity is not a side story, but a central flavor in the national recipe. Diaspora and the Dugla identity. One of the most profound expressions of Indo-Jamaican revival is the rise of Dugla identity, the cultural and familial blending of Indian and African heritage. Once treated with suspicion or stigma, Dugla children now proudly embrace both traditions. They speak patois with Bhojpuri intonation. They eat curry goat and oxtail. They light candles for Diwali and sing at gospel service. Some Douglas have become cultural ambassadors, musicians, poets, journalists, speaking openly about the pain and power of mixed identity. Their voices are helping Jamaica move past old racial binaries and embrace a more inclusive Caribbean future. Leaders, artists, and public figures today, Indo-Jamaicans are present in every sector of Jamaican life. In politics, they've served in parliament, local councils, and public commissions. In sports, names like Rajiv Marag and Sean Bridgemohan have graced international horse racing. In music, chutney singers like Johnny Maiku keep the folk rhythms alive. In culinary circles, chefs like Raja Mara have fused Indian flavors with Jamaican flair. And in everyday life, in pharmacies, classrooms, construction sites, and studios, Indo-Jamaicans are not seen as outsiders. They are neighbors, teachers, mentors, dreamers, fully Jamaican, fully themselves. The revival is not a return. It's a rising. The modern Indo-Jamaican revival is not about going back to India. It's about going forward with identity intact. It's about honoring the journey of those who crossed the sea in chains of contract and built lives in the shadow of plantations. It's about reclaiming history without shame. And it's about teaching the next generation that cultural pride is not separation. It is strength. To wear a kurta in Kingston, to dance tassa in Montego Bay, to teach a child the meaning of dia in St. Elizabeth. That is the revival. That is resistance. That is Jamaican. Chapter 8, Names, Faces, and Legacy. The people who shaped Indo-Jamaican history. History is not made by contracts or colonial decrees. It is written on faces. It is spoken in kitchens. It is sung in temples, whispered in prayers, and remembered in names passed down like heirlooms. For over 175 years, Indo-Jamaicans have shaped the island not just through food, religion, and labor, but through leadership, creativity, and presence. This final chapter pays homage to the people, known and unknown, whose lives embody the legacy of India in Jamaica, from numbered laborers to family names. When Indians first arrived on Jamaican plantations, they were stripped of their full names, given registration numbers instead. It was dehumanizing, intentional, and systematic. And yet, over time, names returned. Some retained their ancestral surnames, anglicized through colonial spelling. Others adopted titles that reflected profession, place, or pride. Today, names like Maiku, Marag, Jaghai, Singh, Pirsad, Bridge Mohan, Ramzaran, Gopal, and Chatur are not just markers of Indian origin. They are Jamaican legacies. They appear on birth certificates, business signs, university diplomas, and gravestones. These names are spoken in parliament, sung in songs, cooked into recipes, etched into cultural history. Voices that echo, artists, musicians, and storytellers. Though many Indo-Jamaicans remain humble in profile, several emerge as national cultural contributors. Johnny Maiku, a pioneer in Jamaican chutney music, fused Brajpuri melodies with Caribbean soul, singing of love, migration, and community. His music resonated across generations, often performed at weddings and festivals from St. Mary to Westmoreland. Traditional drumming groups like Raja Sarangi kept Indian percussion alive, blending Tassa rhythms with mento and ska, creating a soundtrack for multicultural Jamaica. Meanwhile, poets and folklorists began telling Indo-Caribbean stories that had long been excluded from Jamaica's mainstream narrative. Stories of arranged marriages, barrack life, Jose drums, and Dugla identity. Today's youth carry the torch through dance, social media, and fashion, infusing everything from TikTok trends to YouTube documentaries with the rhythms and style of Indian heritage. Race into glory, Indo-Jamaicans in sports. In a nation known for its athletic prowess, Indo-Jamaicans have made their mark, particularly in horse racing. Rajiv Marag and Sean Bridge Mohan, both born to Jamaican parents of Indian descent, rose to international acclaim in the United States. Their victories on racetracks from Belmont to Churchill Downs brought pride not only to Jamaica, but to Indo-Caribbean communities worldwide. They became symbols of cross-cultural excellence, proof that Indo-Jamaicans weren't just preserving traditions, but competing on the world stage. Culinary legends and cultural diplomats. In kitchens across the island, countless Indo-Jamaican women and men became cultural custodians through food. Chefs like Raja Marag helped popularize roti, curry, and faluri far beyond family homes, bringing Indo-Jamaican cuisine into fine dining, festivals, and television features. But just as vital were the grandmothers and market vendors who never made headlines, but who fed generations with turmeric-stained fingers and hearts full of memory. Their recipes, passed from hand to hand, have preserved not just taste, but identity. They are the unofficial diplomats of culture, conducting outreach one pot at a time. Teachers, historians, and cultural advocates over the past few decades, Indo-Jamaicans have entered classrooms, boardrooms, and legislative halls with growing confidence. Teachers, professors, and researchers have become stewards of heritage. Scholars like Dr. Ajay Mansingh, author of The Indian Heritage in Jamaica, have worked tirelessly to archive the Indo-Jamaican experience, tracing migration patterns, cultural fusion, and untold narratives. Their work ensures that future generations will not have to rediscover their roots from scratch. Others serve on cultural councils, school boards, and government committees, advocating for heritage recognition, curriculum inclusion, and public awareness. Through their work, Indian Arrival Day, Diwali celebrations, and Hosai observances are now national cultural staples, not footnotes. Everyday legacy, the quiet revolutionaries. But perhaps the greatest Indo-Jamaican legacy lies in the everyday people whose names don't appear in headlines, but whose lives shape the nation. The cane cutter who saved to send his daughter to school. The seamstress who stitched saris from old curtains. The fisherman who prayed to Hanuman before launching his boat. The mixed-race child who learned Hindi songs while drumming to reggae. The grandmother who told stories of Calcutta nights and Clarendon sunrises. The father who taught his children to be both Indian and Jamaican unapologetically. These are the revolutionaries who never raised fists but raised families. Never held office but held history. Never wrote books but became them. Final reflections. Indo-Jamaican history is not a sidebar in Jamaica's national story. It is one of its main chapters, written in curry, carved in cane, danced in Hosai, and spoken in both English and Bhojpuri. It is a history of pain, but also of beauty, of cultural survival in the face of colonial erasure, of integration without assimilation, of remembering who you are, even when the world tries to forget. The names matter, the faces matter, and the legacy lives on in every drumbeat, every roti, every prayer, every name proudly spoken aloud. This is not just the end of a documentary. It is the continuation of a legacy still unfolding across classrooms, kitchens, dance halls, and temples. Jamaica's Indian heritage is not the story of people who came and stayed. It is the story of people who arrived, endured, evolved, and became.